Yes. Okay. This will be the actually the last question about the first tape. The first tape. Okay. If they knew of your thesis in France, which was the French money supply.
Yes.
Yet there was no knowledge of this. Were they interested in your thesis? Did they know about it?
They mostly were very skeptical about the idea of that first, the French were not great believers in, many of them were not very great, strong believers in econometrics. Now, there are some exceptions to that, and there was a seminar run at the time that I was there that I went to by the French, in French, on using econometric methods. But many of the French, the mainline French economists, those in the universities, were not interested in that. But they particularly didn't believe that money had anything to do with inflation.
Did they know anything about coals?
Well, I'm sure they knew about coal.
But that was...
Well, science develops slowly, so that there's always people who are doing new things and many people who are skeptical about them. And sometimes the skepticism is justified. So they were very strongly believed that measurement and testing of economic theory and the way in which it was being done was not possible. It was not possible to get useful information that way.
What interests me is that your thesis, it was the French money supply from 1938 to 1954, and we're talking about wartime and post-war time.
Yeah.
Was that the reason for your choice of those particular years? Or?
Well, I was interested in the effects of the French money supply on inflation. And, of course, the French had a big inflation. But I was also interested in seeing whether the theory that we had of the early parts of the theory about how money supply gets determined, whether those would hold up under that period. As I wanted to test my theory, and I was also interested in the role of money in inflation. And that was to be what I was going to do after I finished my thesis. I never did that. That is, I went on to do some other things, and I was tired of working on the French money supply and French data, so I became interested. I published some papers based upon my thesis, and by that time I was interested in other things.
But did they know about it? Was there anyone there that knew about your thesis?
Oh, I'm sure people knew about it.
But no interest shown at all?
No, there was no interest shown. But that's not unusual.
That's not unusual.
I mean, journals are full of articles, and sometimes people look back at the end of a year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, and they say, oh, now, I really was very skeptical about that when it first appeared, but now that I think about the problem in a different way, it becomes more appealing to me, more interesting to me, and so I want to look at it again. I do that. I mean, that's not uncommon in science. We have many, many examples of things which are discovered, and when you learn, when you think about the problem in a certain way, you say, oh, now I understand what that was all about, and maybe that's more interesting than I could have believed or would have believed at the time. So the French, have now adopted a monetary system which is very much more along the lines that I was doing things in the end of the 1950s, but for many, many years they were very highly skeptical of what I had done.
How about other European countries?
Well, later, we, through my joint work with Brunner and others, we had very good and fruitful relations, particularly with the German Central Bank and with others in Europe, and to an extent, the Swiss National Bank. I mean, the Swiss National Bank probably came closer to using the very same approach toward monetary control that we had advocated, and I believe that was one of the reasons why they had less inflation than most of the other countries around them. The Germans also were very interested and adopted a modified form of some of the things that we had proposed or that grew out of the work that we had been doing.
When did the Marshall Plan...
Marshall Plan began in 1948.
Okay, so did there was
Marshall's
there any...
speech was in the summer of 1947.
So it was implemented, a year or two later? Or?
No, began in 48.
It did begin
it
in 48.
It ran through to 52.
Okay. I would like now, you were a young couple, you have had a baby.
Right.
You were in Paris. Could you describe life in Paris a little bit away from your professional life?
Sure. Well, they had... finding an apartment was very hard. I think I described probably last time how we shared this apartment with an emigre Russian couple who were white Russians, that is, emigres from the Tsar's regime. And life was pretty grim for most French people at that time. The war was over by more than 10 years when I came there, but they were having the beginnings of what later were the kinds of problems that brought De Gaulle to power in 1950. When did De Gaulle come in? We were there in 1956. I think he came to power in 1958. People were beginning to plant bombs. There was a big, not very much, but there was a big tension between the right and the left. The Communist Party, of course, was active and had a big part of the seats in the parliament. The government was very weak under the Republic and not able to solve or make much progress. They still had price controls on lots of things, ordinary things that we take for granted, Kleenex, paper products generally were not available. There were nothing like baby food available. We finally were able, through my wife's effort, she's an extraordinarily resourceful person, she was able to get permission from the American embassy to shop in the commissary that was available for embassy employees, only to buy baby food. And so we bought baby food. Otherwise, you had to boil a carrot, mash it, something like that, throw away all the vitamins in the water. And I mean, it was really... So life was not just simple, but it was difficult for Frenchmen, not just for us. That isn't to say that we didn't have a good time. We had a good time, but it was anything but living well. We had good friends there. We used the time to travel a bit. I worked hard on trying to collect the data for my thesis, so we didn't travel a great deal, but we went to England for the first time, took Bruce with us, visited a friend that I had met who was a British chemist, and traveled around a bit, went to with them, traveled through the Cotswolds, left Bruce at a nursery in Banbury Cross, you know, as in the nursery rhyme. We left him at a nursery in Banbury Cross for a few days while we traveled around, brought him home, he was picked him up. He was terribly ill, got terribly ill, and we stopped there. I remember at the time he was less than a year old. We stopped at the in Dover, where we were going to take the ferry. We stopped in Dover and we took him to the health service, National Health Service, which of course was free because it had been socialized at that time. And he had, the doctor treated him, reassured us that there was nothing seriously wrong, gave us some medication, and he got better in the next few days. Anyway, so we went there. We also took a trip through in March. We had arranged, there was a family named the Donners, for whom the Donner Pass in California is named, and we arranged with them to have a babysitting exchange. They were there on a Fulbright. He was a professor, I think, at Stanford, and interested in radio and TV. So we arranged the baby exchange with them. We took care of their baby while they went away. And they had several children, but included a little girl named, as I recall, Tamsin, for the woman who was the mother of the family that had that got caught in the snowstorm in the Sierras when they went through. You know, Donner passes name for the family that was stayed there in the midst of a big snowstorm of, I think, 1848. I'm not sure about that date, but in any case, they got snowed in and were trapped there. Well, anyway, Tamsin stayed with us and them for an equivalent period of time. Bruce went to live with the Donners. And Marilyn and I went to Italy, where it rained almost every day, but we went to Florence, and we had bought a car. You could buy a car in France if you had dollars. Frenchmen had to wait months, years to get cars. So we had some dollars, so we bought the car and learned to drive in France, which was no easy trick, at least for me. And finally took a trip to Italy. So those were the main excursions we took, I guess, during that period. Came back to Switzerland. The rest of the time, we lived in Paris. We tried to go to some of the musical events and other things there. Neither of us spoke French. Both of us didn't speak French well, and my wife had never studied French. My had never studied French. So we couldn't go to the theater very often, but we would go to the ballet and things of that kind.
Have you ever retraced your steps since?
Well, we've gone back... I guess a few years ago, while I was there, as I was there on a Fulbright and a Social Science Research Council grants, and while I was there as a Fulbright, I had to be enrolled nominally in some part of the university, and so I moved around a little bit and finally chose a school called the Institute of Political Science, or Sciences Politiques, as it's known, or the French call it Sciences Po, and I didn't do anything there except use their library for a while, and then I didn't even do that. But years later, in 1992, I went back as a professor and gave some lectures on a book that I had just completed on political economy, and I gave the lectures at that same school. And so while we were there for about a month, and we rented, or we actually had an apartment within three blocks of where we had lived in 1956. So, and of course, I've been back to France many times, but on that trip, we actually lived for a period just in the same neighborhood that that we had lived in before. Things were substantially better. We had more money, and and France, of course, was a very different France than what it had been in 1956.
You mentioned then President de Gaulle. For record, could we go back to de Gaulle when he was general, you know, during the liberation, and be sort of interesting if we could get that on tape?
Well, I don't have any direct experience with that. I was not in the war. I was too young.
Right.
I remember, since this is June 8th,
mm-hmm.
June 8th, I remember watching the events of, or listening to the events of the invasion. Mostly in those days, when boys finished high school, they went into the army, and of course, I was in the first class that graduated after the war had ended. So the people who had been in the previous class, of course, had all gone in the army. Many of them had fought in France, and so I knew a lot of those people, but I didn't have any direct involvement at all.
But you do remember that?
Oh, I remember de Gaulle, yes, of course, and all the politics that between Roosevelt and de Gaulle. De Gaulle was a very difficult man, at least as he was presented, and didn't get along very well with Churchill or Roosevelt or Eisenhower. He had his own strong views about himself, about France, but I have no first-hand knowledge of that.
I would like you... to elaborate a little bit of, if you know more than you've already told us, about the Donner Pass.
I've told you most of what I know.
Okay.
And I later heard the whole story. It was, I think, it was during the Gold Rush period when so many Americans were coming, and the Donners were late. That party was late getting up into the Sierras, and then they had an early snowstorm, and it was a huge snowstorm, and they were many of them died. Only a few were survivors. They began, of course. I mean, what's most famous and striking about it was not only that they were caught there, but they began to eat human flesh because that was the only food that they had available. And, one of the women, one of the strong women in that group, was Tamsin Donner. This little girl was named about her. It was named for her. I hadn't known much about the Donners or why the pass was called the Donner Pass between coming from Reno into Sacramento. I mean, when you go over the Sierras between Reno and Sacramento. I had not known very much about it. My wife, who was a Californian when she grew up, had, of course, knew about it, but didn't know anything about the history. She just knew that there was a thing called the Donner Summit Later, of course, we got interested in. There was a TV program on the Donner family and the problems of the Donners just a few years ago. And what I know, I really learned from that.
You have some very interesting pictures up on your wall, and I'd like to start asking you some questions about it. The first question, picture that I'm going to, since there are several of you, one alone of President Reagan, there are three actually when you're together, and did you spend any time with President Reagan, and what brought you there? And
well, we're getting way far ahead in the story.
Okay.
These are...
take me where you want to.
Well, this is in 1988. There's the president has something called the Council of Economic Advisors. There are three people and a staff of perhaps 30 people who originally established as part of the what is known as the Full Employment Act. And it established the Council of Economic Advisors and gave them responsibility for advising the president on steps that he could take to maintain high employment and purchasing power, or some words to that effect. And so over the years, that's become an important advisory institution. It's part of the White House office, so it sits in the executive office of the president, what used to be what's called the old State Department building, the building that originally housed the State, War, and Navy departments, right alongside, on one side of the White House, and the other side of the White House, the Treasury Department. So in that building are all the executive offices, executive agencies of the president. So when you hear that somebody works at the White House, they may very well not be in the White House at all, but more likely they're going to be, since the White House is pretty small, they're most likely in the executive office of the president building, which is now called familiarly the EOB. So the Budget Bureau is in there, the Council of Economic Advisors, the National Security Agency, and other presidential agencies. Well, I had been invited or asked on a couple of occasions whether I would be interested in serving on the Council of Economic Advisors. Usually people go for 2 years, that is, many of them are academics, and they go for a 2-year period, and I had not wanted, I'd never been interested enough to want to do that for 2 years. 2 years is a long time, and I didn't think the experience was sufficiently interesting to want to give up 2 years of my life to do that. But in the summer of 1988, my friend Burl Sprinkle, who was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors and who had been the Undersecretary of the Treasury in the first 4 years of the Reagan administration and then had become chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in the last 4 years of the administration, asked me if I would, as he had done on many occasions, whether I would be willing to come or whether anybody, I knew anybody who would be willing to come for the last 4 months of the administration and to do what is usually described as the macroeconomic part of the council's job. And I said, to his surprise, I said, yes, I would talk to Marilyn and see whether she was interested, but I thought that maybe I would be interested for 4 months. So that's how I got there. I got there. Now, I had decided for mainly personal reasons. I didn't want to resign from everything that I had belonged in my life, which you have to do if you go into government employment, that I would not be confirmed as a member of the council, but I would be an acting member, and I would function in that capacity. And they put various restrictions on what I could and couldn't do. Most of them turned out not to be, when it suited the government's advantage, they removed the restrictions or just ignored the restrictions. Such things as, for example, daily, the president's chief aides, led by the chief of staff, has a meeting early in the morning, and at which they talk about what is going to go on that day, what important events are going to happen that day, so that everybody in all these agencies at least know what the other ones are doing and what's likely to happen, so to speak, on that particular day. For example, there may be a bill before Congress which is coming up, or there may be some particular meeting which is taking place. So it's a place where all these White House agencies exchange information. Well, I was barred from that meeting because I was not a congressionally confirmed appointee had taken this acting role, but when it became useful to have me attend and something like that, they waived those restrictions. So I had, I think, all of the experience that I would have had under any set of circumstances, and that's how I got involved. I mean, my responsibilities were to look out for what was going on in the macroeconomics part of the thing, but Beryl Sprinkle, that's BERYL SPRINKEL, was an old friend, and the other council member was a man named Thomas Moore. And Tom was also an old friend, and he had been my colleague at Carnegie some years in the 1960s. So we functioned in a very collegial way. That was very much Sprinkle's way of running things. And we didn't really have much problem about taking each other's responsibilities and doing them if the other person was away doing something or had something else that he had to do at that time. So I really had a full range of those experiences, of the experiences of working in the council, doing that job without having to spend 2 years. So that was really why I decided to do it. So I served from about the early part of September 1988 until President Reagan left office in January 20th, 1989.
Did you get a chance to spend any time at all with the president?
Well, of course, the president's a busy person, so you don't spend, you don't drop in in chat. But when we had business together, as those pictures suggest, we would see him both ceremonially or for some issue would be discussed. I might have to make a presentation or brief Sprinkle, who would more often make the presentation, but I might be there, a quiet little mouse at the edge of the room, making sure that he got it right, and if he didn't, passing him a note to say, no, that's not what we want to say, or something like that.
What kind of an impression?
Usually got it right. Usually Sprinkle got it right.
Okay.
We would brief him in advance of what it was. And for example, if it was in one of the areas I was responsible for, I would be responsible for giving him a briefing. But of course, I had staff people who would help me do that, and similarly with Tom Moore. So, and that was how that was really what my role was. I had every year. The president puts out something called the Economic Report of the President. So one of my responsibilities was to edit that book, that is to get that written between September and January. That is, it's an event. There are three big events. In January, the president makes the State of the Union address. He presents the budget to Congress, which is his economic plan, and he discusses what's going on in the economy, the U.S. and the world economy, and that's the economic report of the president. So those are the three main documents that the president puts out every January. This was an election year, so we had to do all that early. There would be no State of the Union address because the president was leaving, but there had to be a budget presented, and there had to be this book written. So we chose to use that book to summarize the Reagan presidency, or at least major aspects of the Reagan presidency, his economic policy, his philosophy.
So this is the economic report of the president.
President. There's one every year.
Every year. And you did the, is this the one?
Well, I didn't do it. I was responsible for getting it done. My writing in it is limited. What I did was organize other people, make sure that it was all consistent, reflected the views of the administration. That is, the people who are on the staff are mostly civil servants, so, and they're non-political. I'm a political appointee, and so is Sprinkle and Moore, so our job is to see that, their job is to see that this is well done, good economics. Our job is to see that it reflects the president's views, right? That is, that we are presenting the president's message. Since this was the last report, the president was leaving office, we tried to present what his view, what his overall guiding philosophy had been, and how much of it we had been able to be accomplished in the 8 years that he was president.
Is there a conflict then at times? I mean, was there a conflict? I mean, with
no
you?
No conflict.
Or, not at all, intellectually or?
No, the conflicts the conflicts were with other departments. I mean, in order to make sure there were no conflicts, I thought a little bit about how to organize. There are horror stories about these reports, about people spending all night in their offices, night after night, sleeping on the couch, having food brought into them, trying to get this thing done. I was determined that that wasn't going to happen on my watch, and so I thought about a lot before I began to do this, about how one should organize to do this and to avoid these conflicts. I mean, there are stories that were told to me about people writing chapters and having them thrown away because the person who was responsible, or the committee, the council that was responsible for, didn't agree with the views expressed in the chapter, and all kinds of conflicts of that kind. And people will then have to rewrite those chapters at the last minute. Well, I was hopeful and that I could organize in a way that would prevent that from happening. So I decided most of these people came from academic backgrounds. The best way to do that was, how do academics do these things normally? We have a seminar, and we discuss it all there. And so what I did was had a seminar in my office and got people to write early parts of their report, so they would, and then they would come in and they would report on it. And in that way, I would influence, tell them, well, that isn't exactly the way we want to present that. I mean, or, you know, have you thought about this or that? So on. And then, but by having everybody there that was writing the report, they got an idea about what I thought we wanted to present as the main thrust of the report. And they also understood what all the others were doing. So we didn't have those conflicts at the end. The conflicts we had were with other parts of the government. So the other parts of the government have to read the report. And that's where the conflicts come in. For example, the Treasury would read part, the USTR, which is another presidential agency, the office of the USTR is the U.S. Trade Representative. And of course, we would comment on trade. Trade is a contentious issue in every administration because there are people who believe in relatively free and open trade, and there are people who believe in protection. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration. There are conflicts between agencies, and sometimes intense conflicts. There was a conflict about what we were doing. A big issue at the time was the international debt of developing countries and what the U.S. policy toward the debt should be, and what the president's policy ought to be or might be, and how it might evolve. So, and there were others. I mean, agriculture will be an issue at times. So there were conflicts. And in order to resolve or minimize these conflicts, Burl Sprinkle had, beginning in October, had me go around with him to the principal agencies, the Secretary of State and a group of his advisors.
Who was that?
George Shultz at the time. The Secretary of the Treasury and a group of his advisors. Baker had left, and he remained through the Bush administration. His name will come back to me. Anyway, he's from New Jersey. I just can't think of his name at the moment. He had been a senator very briefly. We had to consult him. We consulted the Office of Management and Budget, which was at that time headed by Jim Miller, the man who just ran for senator from Virginia. And we went to some other agencies, and we presented what we were going to do. So that was a way of giving them an overview of what we intended to do. But then of course, there's a lot in what you say and how you say it. So we would have conflict with them. The Federal Reserve would read the report because we talked about monetary policy. And all of these people are sensitive about what you say about them, as you can imagine. You know, we have one government, but it has many heads. And the president is of course, the nominal head of these things. But many of these people have ideas which differ from those of the president. And there's a constant battle going on to try to change the president's mind and get him to do various things. So expressing opinions of these kinds, of the kind that we do, that every economic report does, sets off conflicts within the administration. So we had to resolve those conflicts. So that's where I had conflict.
What did you think of the president?
Well, I thought the president was terrific. I mean, I thought he had great strengths, enormous strengths. You might say he knew who he was and what he believed in. And he rarely deviated, in my experience with them, both as an outside observer and as a working person. He rarely deviated from his basic beliefs. He didn't care a lot about the details. He cared about the ultimate thing. He was a very wise and politically astute person. He knew that there were more than one way to accomplish an objective, and that what was important was how you accomplish the objective. He was smart enough to know that if you got 80% of what you went after, it was better to get that, to take that 80%, than to sacrifice everything because you couldn't get the last 10 or 20%. So in that sense, he was very sure. But he kept himself clearly focused on his objectives. And that's, I would say, is rare, not unique by any means, but rare among presidents. He had a strategy where he wanted to go.